personal items. Two at a time.
Thank you.
So where's Jim?
Call to order the meeting of the Board of Legislators Legislation Committee. And we have a quorum, I believe, as well as enough to start a meeting. We're joined by legislators Burton, Burroughs, Harkin, Abenanti, Williams, Alfreda, and Nona John.
Mr. Nona, Mr. Pinto sat on this committee, right?
Oh,
I believe so. We're now joined by legislators Rogowski, Mezano, and Myers.
Are we looking for another person maybe to join the legislation?
I'll raise it with the chair. Sorry, I'm late. You're not that.
You're supposed to be down here, sir.
Okay, we have two items on the agenda today. Let me just start by saying for the first few months of this year, we spent most of our time with items that had been held over from last year that had been discussed but no action had been taken. This year, at this point, we are now beginning to consider items that, as far as I know, have not been considered in any kind of depth, if at all, within the last 2 years. Some of them may have been proposed before that, but to my knowledge, they had not gotten extensive treatment or have not seen the light of day. So we're now getting into new areas, perhaps controversial areas, but areas that I think should be debated and discussed and a conclusion reached as to whether we move forward or not. So the first item we've scheduled today is a proposal regarding the penalties for school tax that was proposed by legislator Abenanti. And I'm going to call upon him to discuss
this. Our old colleague.
And Legislator Pinto, who has moved on to bigger and better things.
I'm going to ask for my counsel to come up here, too. Joanne, are you still in the room?
Yeah.
Why don't you come up here?
So it's Joanne Soule. She's counsel to Legislator.
This is a very complicated area of the law.
Okay,
so I'm going to try to be very brief and then let some of the receivers.
Well, then we're going to have our tax commission Director David Jackson speak, and then we'll open it up to the floor to any of the receivers or assessors or anyone else from the public who would like to speak.
Right. Thank you for considering this. As we know, in this economy, as much as any other time, we have a lot of people who have difficulty paying their taxes. But we have heard from various sources, some citizens, some government officials, that people have, by mistake, not intentionally, good people who want to pay their taxes, either mistake or misfortune, find themselves having missed a deadline and then going in and being told that there is a 10% or 12% penalty on the spot to pay their taxes, and that the municipalities can't take partial payment. They can't take the payment without the penalty. And so some people just throw up their hands and walk away and say, I don't have the extra money. This is particularly a problem with the second half of the school tax. The present law allows municipalities to opt in and break the school tax into two pieces so that the first school tax is due September 1, must be paid by September 30th. And then there's a schedule under the statute which says if you miss it the first month, it's 2%. The second month, I think, was it 3%? Then it goes to 4%. By the time you get to February, it's 10%. And so, now if you come in and miss the second half, you don't get to start over again and say 2% or 4% or 5%. It goes right to the 10%. So a person who might have a $20,000 school tax bill pays the first $10,000 in September, now for whatever reason has difficulty in September, in January, or misses the deadline accidentally, or perhaps bought their house in the interim so that the first part of the tax was paid by the previous owner and they never in fact got the tax bill, so that they missed that second payment. They are faced with a 10% tax? 10%. On February 1.
10% of the whole?
Of the second half.
Oh, just of the
second. Yeah, I originally thought it was the whole, but it's only the second half. But still, if your $20,000 school tax bill, 10% of $1,000 is a lot of money. And I've heard a lot of stories from...
So let's just back up.
So the
bill, there's two installments. One's September. Yeah, they pay the installment in September. and then the February installment comes in, and you're dealing with a situation where they've missed that second installment.
The January, right.
The January installment.
They missed the second installment.
All right. So then as of that date, in January, they have to pay 10%.
Correct.
No.
No, no. As of February 1.
Right.
February
1st. As of February 1st.
Right. Then they have to pay. It's the old schedule coming from September, just continues on. But it applies to the second half. So the suggestion here is that what we try to do is start the payment penalty over again for the first 2 months. Right? For the first 2 months? Is that what we're doing? So the first...
February and March.
Right, so February, now March, we understand the existing law. Now explain your proposal.
Well, the proposal is that if they are late, that for February and March... That you allow it to, is it 2%? Is that what we want to do?
February would be 2%.
That
would be script now. March would be 5%, and then it would be back.
Then it would go to 13%.
And that's what would happen on the first.
That's the proposal. Our proposal is that you give them the initial rate for the first 2 months. Because what we're hearing is there are a lot of people who, for whatever reason, discover that their taxes were due. I mean, we've heard. I'm going to ask the receiver of taxes from Greenberg to explain some of the. He's been there for quite some time. He's got, what, 30,000 parcels?
Yeah, 29.
29,000 parcels. So he has had a broad experience with a lot of different circumstances, and he has no discretion under the present law, and the town board has no discretion. Now, we have heard of certain circumstances around the county where some town boards and some receivers have been looking the other way, or have a policy, or develop the policy, or pass the local ordinance or something, which allows for some procedure. But as best as we can determine, those are not justified by the present law. This is a mandate that you cannot waive. And we've had circumstances in Greenberg. I've had people calling me after they've spoken with the receiver of taxes, saying, "Oh my God, you know, they're looking for $750,000. I scraped together the money to get there, and it got lost in the mail." And it came back.
$7,500.
So the penalty would be $750.
You are the highest tax county, but we're not that high yet.
Right.
But, can I ask a question?
So, you know, when the check comes back in the mail because it got lost or didn't get delivered or whatever, and all of this is after the February date.
That's, can I just ask a question?
All right. So, if any legislators have questions about the proposal, why don't we ask Tom now? And then we'll ask.
That's the whole proposal, right?
David Jackson to come up, and then we'll open it up to any receivers that would like to speak. But questions for Tom and Joanne?
Tom, come if on. I may.
Dave, Mr. Jackson.
So who gets to keep the penalty? The municipality?
The municipality.
So this is revenue, in a way, for the municipality.
Yep.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Hart.
But if I may, it's lost revenue because they don't have the tax.
They have to pay the entire tax to the county.
Right,
and
they can't. The smaller towns can't afford the float.
Right.
But also, we've heard of circumstances where people who just walk away and say, "I can't give you the money because you won't take the tax, and I don't have the extra $750 or whatever it is, so I can't pay you." And so they get into a situation where now it's snowballing. And I look at this and I say, "You know, this is legalized usury. I mean, because you're talking 10% for 1 month." While you think of it in terms of 10% per annum, it's 10% for 1 month. Even the credit card companies don't get that kind of rate.
How many municipalities have to split the two installment plans? Most of them?
We think it's most of them, maybe all of them.
All towns.
Yeah, I don't know if any town does.
That doesn't, right. Right.
All towns.
We should do it for counties once. we don't do the county two installments. That's
right. The county doesn't.
That's next week's.
Commissioner Jackson, can you? Comments? Your comments on this?
I'm basically not here to make a statement or take a position on. Answer any questions. I guess the only thing I could say is, as you're very well aware, the county is not involved in the collection of taxes. So whatever the opinions are of the local tax receivers and those responsible for the collection of taxes, is probably the best way to go. And as I've heard to date, there are a variety of positions on that. So however you would craft something that would work, that would satisfy all.
And again, we're not talking about county taxes or town taxes. We're talking specifically about school taxes.
That are collected by local
town taxes too.
Everybody.
Yeah.
You don't pay, you get hit with a penalty.
Every municipality has, the way I understand it, the law, this is dictated by state law, I think, that says if you miss your timely payment by one day, you have no discretion, as Tom said. You've got to pay a penalty. And as a councilman, I've had somebody who's died that couldn't make
the payment. This would not apply to the county tax part of the tax.
This is just school.
But the concept is the same. Somebody dies, the estate hasn't put it all together yet, and then they end up paying a 10% penalty because...
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
The penalty schedule is, in essence, the same for all taxes.
Right.
The issue with the school tax is the fact that taxpayers have the option
to
pay in two installments, and then if they miss that one day, the receivers get the phone calls, and then if they're very persistent, they call my office and make the same complaint.
The penalties are set by the county, not by the state.
Right, they're in our local law. But so it's the same penalty schedule, and it's just being applied to the two installment system.
Correct.
To the fact that there's two installments.
And we're suggesting you separate it out for 2 months, so a lower penalty for the first 2 months to encourage people to come forward and pay those taxes.
Legislator Rogowski.
Yeah, well, just to your point, Mr. Chairman, just so we know what tax we're talking about, the caption makes it seem like it's regarding school taxes, but I can only speak for Harrison sets it out, but then allows for two installments with no penalties if you pay the first one and the second one. So with the same penalty schedule, I mean, this is only applying to school taxes.
Correct, only school taxes.
So if someone, if I pay my town tax late, this my second installment.
We're not dealing with that.
Well, that's what I said. So
you have two installments for a town tax?
Two installments for town tax.
Two?
Yeah.
No, we don't.
Okay. Yeah.
Most of the world has only one.
Well, Harris is more progressive.
If this works, you can.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So to the extent, I mean, this is your point. This is limited to school tax. That's what it's limited to. Okay.
This is 283.221, which is okay. You're seeking to amend,
correct.
Applies to state, to county, district, town, and school taxes, right?
No, but look at paragraph 7. It says, the following scale of penalties is hereby prescribed for neglect to pay school taxes.
So 7 is school taxes.
So if we were to do this, is the addition, 6 is what's in the law currently, correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're adding 7.
Right. Notwithstanding Section 6, you're saying Section 7 provides...
6 applies only to school tax.
Right. Okay, so just for the record, there may be just Harrison or some other towns, but that would be, we would have to come back, and if we like this idea, we'd have to come back.
Correct.
And look at that. Okay. Yeah. Now, on...
We've heard complaints about the school
okay.
tax.
Okay. Now, just so... Just to get to the... I mean, I have some opinions, but just get to the facts for the record, David. Do we know the extent of the problem? Is it 1%? I understand the problem.
I think we're going to have to hear that from the receiver.
All right, but just to put into the record, we want to change it because if there's only one person out of a million that this applies to, that's one thing. But if it's 3% or 5% or 10% of the taxpayers, so you want to develop? I'd like to develop that for the record, if we can know the.
I would ask that you ask the Greenberg receiver.
Extent of the problem. Okay, now just for the record. Okay.
Any other questions from the legislators on Legislator Abenaki's proposal? Any other questions for Commissioner Jackson? No.
If I can make just a statement, I'm curious as to the people who actually collect the taxes
from
this, because I've always seen it, we have absolutely no discretion, so it makes it easy for us because now you don't take into account various excuses that people are going to have. So it's, hey, that's it. We have no excuse, absolutely nothing, and that's why
we're not dealing with the question of discretion. We're just saying it seems to be unfair if there's, for that first month. There was a time when people can get 14% interest on their money in the bank, and it made sense, don't pay your taxes, you can, play the game, and so they raised the rates up to whatever they did. But I don't think anybody's doing that today. I don't think there are too many people intentionally not paying their taxes because they're getting more in the stock market or somewhere else.
I guess, so Commissioner, if you want to just sit there, because we're going to ask the Greenberg Commissioner to come up. Yeah, just move over and we'll get the Greenberg Commissioner come up, because Legislator Abenaki, I think, would like him to describe what his...
Is this the hot seat?
That's the hot seat, right?
First of all, Tom, I think what you're referring to in your legislation, if I read it correctly, is you must have the first half paid in order to be able to take advantage of that. You can't just take the second half.
Because the interest would run on the first half up as prescribed in the statute, 2%, 5%, 7%.
Correct. This is only the second half, because what we're hearing is, first of all, the tax bill is not being sent out the second time.
Yes, it is.
And,
yes, it is.
Well, save your comments.
I can tell you what we
In all due respect, I think that the president of the Receivers Association should be first to speak.
Well, but she's against it, right?
Well,
why you get the proponents first?
Back up. Order. We're letting legislator Abernathy make his proposal. He would like to have the Greenberg assessor be part of his proposal, so we'll do that, and then we'll ask Ms. Colombo to come to Madam President. Okay. My constituent, too.
Excuse me.
I have her on the table.
I know there is quite a concern among receivers and among our association about the loss of revenue that would take place, and that's certainly something to be considered. However, I think there's really two ways we have to look at this problem. You can look at it from the point of view of figures, dollar signs, cents, paperwork. That's one way to look at it. There's a second way, and that's actually people like myself who sit in an office and come face to face with the taxpayer day in and day out. I want to give you very, very briefly three scenarios that took place in February and March this year in my office. Scenario number one, a single mom with two children, waiting for the Social Security check, waiting for the IRS check to come back in February to pay her taxes. She used to use it for vacations for the kids, but she wants to pay the taxes with it so she can keep the kids in school in one of our villages. So she said, Mr. Duenas, is there anything you can do? You know, I don't have the extra $475 for the 10%. I am going to pay you, but I have to wait for the IRS check, for the Internal Revenue check to come back. Sorry, I have to follow the law. I have to charge you the 10%. And she says, I'm not sure I'll be able to pay it next month. Number two, senior citizen, okay? Living Social Security to Social Security check. Hers would have been an extra $1,000. She didn't have the money. She was waiting for another Social Security check to come in the following month. She was trying desperately the following month to put together the money. By the way, speaking of senior citizens, you know, the state is starting to chip away at the STAR program. I figured something out before coming over. And that is, I took a senior citizen in Greenberg in 1999 with the same assessment as today, with the STAR program, was paying $1,225 in school taxes. If you were to take the senior STAR away next year, if the state says no more STAR program, her taxes will be $6,654, which is over a 200% increase. So when somebody comes in and you're charging them 10% for missing 1 month, the town tax, 2%. First half school tax, 2%. Second half school tax, 10%. And a final case I'd like to mention, and this happens a lot. This happens quite a bit, probably the most. New homeowner buys in November, December. Okay, first half has been paid in September. The old owner may be dead, may have moved, may be in a state. Homeowner doesn't get the second half of the tax. Okay, no tax bill. We send a reminder postcard in January. What do you think that reminder goes to? The deceased, to Florida, to the person who no longer owns it. We say on the postcard, please contact us or pass this on. Please contact us if you no longer own a property, pass it on. They don't. They don't do it. So the penalties keep accruing. When does the new homeowner find out? When we send the town bill in April, they find out that there is a 12% penalty now on your tax bill, because it says you have back taxes that are due. They come and say, Mr. Winnell, I never got a bill. Well, even if we sent a second bill, you wouldn't have got it. It would have gone to the old homeowner. Welcome to Greenberg. I'm sorry, but you owe me a penalty of about $4,000 or $5,000. And they think it's very unfair because they did nothing wrong. They were not told at the closing. They were not given a bill at the closing. They were not told. Many of them are told, don't worry, you'll get a bill. Wrong. We don't bill in January. And if we did, instead of the postcard, again, it's not going to the proper owner.
But why wouldn't the postcard go to the proper owner, since the town, I would imagine, is keeping the records at closing who the new owner is going to be. Right away, something should be done. I would
it
think
gets filed with the county sometimes a week, two, 3 weeks later. The county in turn, we have 29,000 parcels. They turn around and they send it to the assessment office, or it's online. But the only thing we can do, and we try, is, but again, with 29,000 parcels, most people wait till the last several days to pay. So then we send out a reminder notice. But again, if they purchase in November or December, in January, we're not even going to know they're in there very often. Well, very oftentimes we won't know there are people in there. Maybe if we were a smaller community, it would be a little bit easier, but with two full-time people in my office and myself, we depend on the old owner who's getting the mail forwarded. Even if you send it to the address of the property, they're forwarding it on to the other owner.
Can I ask, how many parcels in the city of Yonkers, if you know?
That's the city. The city is different than a town.
The city of Yonkers is the only municipality, I believe, that's larger than us as far as the number of parcels are concerned. They're a little bit larger than we are.
Cities sometimes set up multiple payments beyond twice. They have a different charter.
I believe this applies only to towns because the language in here says if the town board has adopted a resolution.
The city has three.
I wanted to give you a few facts. Tom, you had asked for some facts before.
Right.
Okay, out of 29,000 parcels, we had approximately 1,100 people who did not pay in January. Okay, 700 of the 1,100 are not going to pay under any circumstances. They're going to end up paying as liens later on in a year. They're just not going to pay.
Seven out of the 11?
700 of the 1,100. Who are these other 400? They're people, like I mentioned this morning. They're people who are out of work. I had a call from a fellow before I came over here who's lost his job. He's been out of work for 8 months and just doesn't know how he's going to come up with the money. I did some calculating. 10% versus 2% of the penalties in January, compared to the amount of monies I have to collect for the school, comes out to 0.0092% of my entire school warrant.
And what's that in money, in cash?
In cash, it's probably about, before the 10%, as a matter of fact, I brought the sheet with me. Okay, before the, at 10%, it was $228,000. At the 2%, let's see, what would it be? 57,100, okay? That would be the difference to the town of Greenberg. However, as someone mentioned before too, we have to pay the schools whether we collect the money or not. Someone pays it at 2% and doesn't pay it at 10%, then we're going to be out monies anyhow as far as the tax is concerned. So maybe somebody could afford to pay it at the 2% and couldn't pay it at the 10%. We collect the money. We have to make good to the school. We have 10 school districts. My warrant's almost, I think, close to $300 million for the 10 school districts we collect for. And again, if somebody could afford to pay the 2%, we would at least get the monies when we pay the school. But the final thing I'd like to say, and I thank you for your attention, is to me the most important thing here, and this is the way I feel personally. I'm an elected official. I was elected to meet the needs of all the people who elected me. Not just the needs of those who can at present time afford to live here. So my whole thing is, if this is going to help, all right, so it's not going to help, maybe it won't help a high enough percentage of the people to satisfy your needs to change the law. But again, I'm sitting in the office with these people day in and day out. They're hurting. They're looking for help. They want to pay their taxes. They're just not in a position to do it. And I think I have an obligation to them as well, which is why I would be in favor of trying to find something that would ease their burden at this time. Thank you for your...
Can I just ask one question?
Well, are there any questions for...
Did you tell them that... Were you the one who told me the story about the one that was lost in the mail?
Lost in the mail?
Do you know what the story is?
Well, unfortunately, the mail service isn't what it used to be, but I can tell you that probably. Every year we get some that are lost in the mail. This woman put it in the mail, and she didn't get a receipt. She didn't realize she had to get a receipt, and it got lost in the mail. I mean, I believe she did mail it, but again, she could have.
Was it a credit card circumstance, though?
She paid the temp. She found out after the fact. She mailed it in good faith the last day or two of the collection. And of course, you could say, well, she waited. She shouldn't have waited, but maybe she had to because she's putting the money together. So it gets lost in the mail. She finds out, and we send a reminder notices 2 weeks later that we don't have her payment. Now give me 10% on top of that.
Was there a circumstance?
Well, one of the initial stories, so to speak, that prompted legislator Abinanti to consider this law was a constituent that contacted us who had apparently mailed out 5 checks at the same time. And when he got back his MasterCard bill, saw that it was unpaid, there was interest on that. And apparently, whatever happened with these checks didn't happen in the mail. It happened from the bank's end in terms of not being presented, not being paid. So the MasterCard bill tipped him off that there was a problem. He knew he mailed out 5 checks that same day that obviously didn't get presented or had some problem, called Dave to find out that he was indeed going to owe $7,000 plus the $700, and very, very angry, wrote to him, wrote to us, and that's when we started to begin to hear the stories of the people that were impacted. He sent his by certified mail, so Dave explained to him he could go to the post office and get certain proof, whatever, and which he did over time. He, I think, got the refund. But those are the kinds of stories that have prompted the concern and therefore the proposal.
We had a woman that paid online. She ended up paying a $1,000 penalty. She inadvertently, she paid 2 or 3 days before the end of the collection online. She went to an account that was no longer open inadvertently. She made a mistake. It came back to me 3 days after collection had ended. State law is very clear. You cannot take it without the penalties. It was not paid in a timely manner. So she ended up paying $1,000. I think it would have been a lot easier in her case if she had paid 2% than the 10%. But these are situations that I think are worth listening to. And I thank you for your time.
There might be some questions for you.
Again, on the law, I've never been clear. If someone mails the taxes on the last day of the month, is this like your federal tax? Is that qualifier, or it has to be in your hands?
If you have a postmark from the United States government, if you mail it overnight, UPS. A postmark from either the government, not a meter, it can be turned back, but a postmark from the government or a FedEx, UPS, something that shows one-day delivery. If it's delivered on the 1st, you know it was mailed on the 30th.
All right, so you checks come in this couple of days late, you wait to count.
I have to keep the envelopes in case the auditors ask me why I put them in 3-4 days late without the penalties, and I have to show them that particular envelope. Okay. That's how close we're ordered.
Do you have a number of a figure for uncollected penalties that you haven't been able to collect?
Uncollected in a sense of, I'm sorry.
The people have just haven't paid, and it's become a lien.
Normally,
you can't collect the money without the penalty.
I just wonder what
percentage of the people go to lien each year,
or what the
get it eventually.
Forget the number of taxes, but the amount of uncollected penalties. You pointed out the amount of collected penalties, I believe.
Well, it said 7 out of 1,100 won't pay.
So they'll eventually get it one way or the other.
But the town is out the money for a while.
Well, in the short term.
I don't know penalty-wise. I know warrant-wise, if we're collecting $500 million in warrants, usually we collect about 99.2% of the school, 98.7% of the town. So we have somewhere in the vicinity of maybe 23 or 2,200 parcels or 2,000 parcels that go to lien out of the 29,000. I'm not sure exactly how many parcels, but about a little over 2 million out of the 500 million we're supposed to collect. We don't collect. So if you take the 2 million times 12%, what do you come up with? That's
24.
Right. Many of the banks today, by the way, are paying for people in the past where they didn't, so our collection rates are staying up, and the reason they are is because banks are now checking very closely. If you pay your own mortgages, they're making sure it's paid years ago. They didn't do that. So our collections are holding fairly steady, even in these tough economic times, because banks are making good where people are not. Again, the percentage of people who seem not to be paying are those who would like to pay but just can't afford to at this point in time, from my point of view.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Colombo, do you want to come up next? And this is Patricia Colombo. She is the receiver for North Castle and the president of the Westchester Receivers Association.
Joanne Bassey from Lewisburg, who's the vice president.
Sure. Come on up. Thank you.
The ones that are
anybody else who wants to
crowd the front.
Anyone who wants to speak, have a seat. There's plenty of seats. So, Nancy, you want to come up? Have a seat. Anybody else? We have enough seats. 1, 2, 3, 4. There's a seat right here. There's a seat here. There's two seats right there. So just please identify yourself before you speak so we keep straight the same one.
Patricia Colombo, I'm the receiver of taxes from the town of North Castle. And I'm also the president of the Westchester Association.
I'm Joanna Bossi, receiver of taxes for the town of Lewisboro, right. And vice president of the Association.
I'm Mary Browning, receiver for the town of Portland.
Okay. Nancy Macy, receiver for the town of Harrison. Mm-hmm.
Karen Roach, receiver for the town of North Sound.
Okay, who would like to speak first? Okay. Well, President Colombo.
It's not an issue of being so hard-nosed, you know. I'm there 19 years, a little bit about the same time. And you get a bill. On the back of the bill, it has a penalty schedule. You put in a legal notice in three papers. That penalty schedule is on there. I'm lucky in North Castle because we have to do final meter readings when a home is sold. Mm. So I know immediately when there's a new owner. I think in the past 5 years, there may have been literally two people we didn't know about. And it's only 5,000 parcels, so it's easy to, you know, keep track of. And I've noticed that it's the same people that pay late. There may be not even a handful that they forgot, or they were on vacation and they didn't get the money in, or they wait, they said they mail the check in and you don't get it, but it's the same people all the time. Now, we did get someone who said they paid it on the last day, and he paid the penalty. It came to my office 5 weeks later, so I issued him a refund. You know, so that does happen. They say, "Oh, I paid," and you go, "Oh, it's your subject, right?" But he did, and I issued him a refund. You know, I had copies of the posted envelope from the United States Post Office. But I find that it's the same people, and I don't see where a law should be changed to give additional people that extra time to pay late. Now, North Castle pays on the 15th of April any outstanding school amount. We have 5 school districts. So I think just for that, the handful of people that may pay late for another reason, whereas it's the exact same people. I go through it every year to see if it's the same people. They'll come in and say, "I don't want to pay this penalty. I never pay late. Can't you do something for me?" And then you look into the computer. I have one on my counter, and they pay late every time for the past 10 years. So in North Castle, I would vote.
The new homeowner situation, you don't run into that problem?
We never have that trouble. I mean, we're lucky because it's small enough to handle. And like I said, because they have to do a final meter reading for water.
But everybody has, doesn't Greenberg have to do a water meter reading?
I collect water in my office.
Who collects it?
Just the villages.
Yeah, so that would eliminate half of Greenberg.
It's only the unincorporated part of the town that collects.
Yeah, and I collect for the 5 water districts.
Very few people.
The private.
So I collect for 5 water districts. So when I know that there's a closing, let's say there's a closing today, I'll get a newcomer packet ready, and I will mail it to them. I'll give it a couple of days to get into the house. And so this way, I know immediately if they have an escrow or if the tax isn't paid. That's only happened maybe a few times in the past 5 years.
Question. How do you know the new owner's name?
because the water, they have to do a final meter reading, and they have to give that information to the attorney for the closing. So I have them fax me the name of the new owner. So I have
who faxes it to you?
Our water department does a reading.
How do they know the new owner?
Because in our town, we on our website, we tell you, if you're new, please call for a final meter reading. Or the old, if you're moving, call
for it's standard to get a final meter reading. But usually what happens is the old owner shows up at the closing with a bill, paid bill.
Right, but in North Castle, we do paperwork so that they can, we fax it to that attorney for the closing, and we ask for that new owner's name. So we already have that new owner's name before they're even in the house.
I've just never seen that. I do closings all the time, and usually
it's the same thing.
Yeah.
Well, down at our end of the county, somebody just shows up with a paid bill, and you check it off. The title company says, okay, paid. Because or the title company calls and checks to make sure it's paid.
Well, most of the time, they're in the middle of that water quarter. So the old owner has to pay that, and the new owner has to pay.
Right, suggested at the closing.
Right, so that the old owner pays the new owner, and they mail the check. So sometimes that check's sitting in my office, in my safe, until that bill is due, because they already know what that amount is. So we always know that new owner before they're in the house.
Okay, interesting. I've never seen that. Anyway.
Any other comments?
Yeah, I'd like to say that I don't believe it's our responsibility. It's the attorney's responsibility to tell the new owner that a bill is due. It is also their responsibility to do a title search. And the title search shouldn't just call up and ask for the amount. They should actually come into the office and find out what the amounts are and when they're due. Every attorney that we deal with knows when taxes are due. I understand, and I've been a receiver for 27 years. This is my 28th year. Probably the longest sitting receiver, not the oldest.
You started in high school as a part-time
before
general.
Before that, part-time
freshman in high school.
In any case, we do our best. I send reminder bills. I send a fiscal bill in December. And on the bill it says, I add a note saying, if you are moving, if you are planning on selling, if you have sold, please contact us. And people do, and they give us the name of the new owner, and that bill is immediately sent to that new owner. And we ask if they've moved in, if they're not moving in, and 9 times out of 10, those owners pay. The people, and as Patty said, the people who don't pay are usually the same people over and over again. And if you give them 2%, they'll wait till 5%. They are constantly people who don't want to pay taxes, basically.
Do you haven't seen the hardship cases?
I have not. Actually, in the last 2 years, our lien list has decreased instead of increased.
No. How many parcels do you have?
58, a little over 5,800.
Okay. Yes.
I have
Mary Browning.
Over 15,000 parcels. Portland is the second largest town. And yes.
Could you identify yourself for the record?
Mary Brown.
I'm Mary Brown, receiver for Cortland.
Thanks.
I've been on the job 8 years. There have been hardships this time around. There definitely have. And theoretically, I know this is what's supposed to happen, but if I have someone who's really, really in a bind and they call me up, because these are different than the people that are just on the list every time. 8 years ago, I had the same people go into lien, and I still have them today. I can recognize the names because it's the first section block and lot in the town. It's the same person. There are things that I work around. I tell people, if you get penalty, I can't take it away, but I can try to help you prevent it. Now, our town has two things where the elderly, those that are most vulnerable, do have extensions, 5-day extensions, so when their check comes in on the first of the month. The other thing that I've done, and I know that this is going to be very controversial, but if someone says to me, Mary, I am in a problem, and this is the person who's sincere, who never comes to this problem, but they're upset or they're embarrassed, I will say to them, mail me that check, give me that postmark, and if I have to hold it a day or two, I will do that for you, because I am protected with my postmark. Now, maybe that is not the best way to interpret the law, but I will do what I can do to help prevent. And I want to say, when people say they're 1 day late, the law says you have the option to pay it in 2 installments. It does not say you have to wait till the last day in January. You actually have 5 months to pay that second half. And when the towns opted in, it was contingent upon a penalty scale. because this April, I'm running at a 99% collection, and that has not changed. Maybe because the banks have stepped in, maybe because there's been foreclosures, but I'm still going to hit my 99%. I'm at 98 for the schools and 99 for last year's town. But this month, we paid out $1.9 million, and everything is relative. So Dave may say he has 30 parcels, but it's relative. We're paying out 1.9. We don't collect anywhere near that on the current penalty scale to make the schools whole, to make sure their cash flow continues, and to uphold what our responsibility is. So to cut that by 2% is huge. And realize they've had the bill for 5 minutes. So why should it be 2% when you've been holding the bill for 5 months? That would be my question. The other thing is, we went to the county and asked, could not the second half of the bill be taken care of at the closing? They said no, because it's not due. No, we can't do that for you. And our town attorney tells us that he sits many times at closings and it's never brought up. But my response is, if I move and I don't get my IRS forms, does that mean I don't get a penalty? No. If you own land, it is very, very evident that you are responsible for the taxes on that land. The other thing that I have available for my people is the second half of the school. I have a credit card available through the state contract, so I think I'm one of the lowest interest on that third party, which is 1.81%. Is that better than 10%? You bet. I don't encourage my people to credit card their taxes, but it's an alternative if you're in a crunch. And the people also that roll the money on us are the developers. I have developers rolling $250,000, several of them, just because they're not going to pay until they're pushed to. And it is a problem with them, and I understand their position. I understand where they're at financially and that they need to develop the land, but that's a burden. That's a huge burden that we pay out on. Postage. If it comes in late, our postage, we will reimburse them of any penalty if they are indeed got lost by the post office. Okay, and what my response to Dave is, you had an example of if they lost Star. Well, that's not even appropriate to the argument, because it's not about Star. It's about the bills were decided to make it more palatable, will give you the ability to pay in two installments, so it's not one stiff bill. And that's what happened, and Star then reduced that, but no one's taking it away today. The policy issue on whether this should happen or not will never come down to the receiver. It will always go to the board of directors. And in my situation, the board has been notified, and they will respond negatively. They will not support this, and I don't know that we have a lot of boards that can afford to financially continue to make everyone whole and then cut down to 2%. Okay, thank you for your time.
Thank you for your comments. Nancy, do you want to say something, or who wants to go first?
Well, we have exactly the same situation. The exact same people.
How many parcels do you have?
About 65 or 70, around that.
Where are you from?
Cortland was in
Harrison. That's Harrison.
Cortland's over 15,000, the second largest. And we have five school districts. I know that Greenberg is the exception because it has twice the amount. But Greenberg also has something, and I'm going to say this, Dave, because it's something that is a concern. Greenberg does not spend as much time as it one spends reimbursing when someone makes a duplicate payment. We are extremely diligent about getting that money back to the individual, to the bank, to the title company, wherever it came from. This is an issue with Greenberg that they've not done this. They have a financially, they've got a hell of a lot more money on their hand from this predicament.
Tom, can I respond to this?
Absolutely. You'll get a chance to respond.
Thank you.
Did you fit it?
Want to respond.
Or we're up to Nancy Massey.
Just highlights the problem.
Ms. Massey, go ahead. Floor is yours.
I'm the receiver of taxes in Harrison, and I've been over 20 years. And we have the exact same people, like Patty said, that never pay on time. Never. And they'll say, I didn't get my bill. And then the next thing you know, they're coming in with their bill. That they did get it. First they say they didn't get it, and there they are coming in with the bill that they did receive it. We do have a lot of people that pay on the very last day, and we accept it. If they pay the last day, even if they mail it on the last day, we go by the postmark. And like I said, the same thing with the builders. They never pay. But otherwise, we have no complaints with most of the people that don't pay, and it's always the same ones. It's never the small man. I send out a bill today, tomorrow, that old man is in there paying that bill the very same day.
It's true.
And they're with cash. They're there the same day you get that bill.
Let's hear from Lewisboro.
I'm North Salem.
I got it.
So I'm
North
definitely
sorry.
The opposite end of Dave, okay. Because I'm the smallest town in Westchester.
Right.
I have approximately 2,900 parcels. I'm with the ladies as far as our collection. We do about 99% of our warrants every year, and we're still at that level. However, I kind of take a slightly different angle from Dave. I, too, am an elected official. My job is to meet the needs of all my people. But in that case, I have to acknowledge the people who realize that they plan in advance to pay on time. We're talking 99% of the people with tax bills. They put their money away. They hit their savings if they're at work.
The chairman was asleep.
We have 99% of our people who do their damnedest to pay. So why, if we change the law, you have to realize, if we don't collect those taxes, and we don't, better yet, we don't collect the penalty, our budgets still need that penalty. So all the people who paid on time are going to get hit with an increased tax rate by the town to compensate for what those few people have to pay. That's not fair. Plain and simple.
You should guarantee
when I live in the town, it's not fair. I don't need to pay for somebody who won't get their act together. There will always be an exception to the rule. Always. And there always have been. Somebody passes away. Somebody's out of work, somebody's spouse dies. Your heart breaks for all of them. But once you make an exception to the rule, you open Pandora's box. And then, where do you draw the line? How do you say it's okay for Mrs. Smith, but it's not okay for Mr. Jones? And you can't do that. That's the bottom line. You have to be hard and true to a point. Your heart breaks for them. You want to help them. But you're going to have lawsuits up the wazoo, folks, when you make that first exception to the rule. The other part of it is...
You understand, of course, we're not making an exception. This would be a standard lower percentage.
Well, what you're discussing, but I'm also hearing other things being bounced around, so I'm kind of addressing this also.
Well, right, but that's why we did not make
those
proposals.
Now, for the second half school tax, okay, you have, you're saying 2%... and then 5%, and then?
13.
10.
10, then 13.
Okay, then 10, 12.
In other words, we're just talking 2 months to revert to the original.
In other counties where they are allowed to pay in installments, their people are charged a fee to use that installment program, just the way you do with your insurance policies. If you choose to pay an installment, you pay an extra amount.
There's like a built-in interest rate for like
exactly.
a larger loan.
Yeah.
Like
we don't do that in Westchester County. Hmm. You get the first 5 months free and clear. So by the time you get to this...
That's a good point. What first 5 months is free?
You do your interest. So we're giving it to you on the house, and we're not as... You know, and you can pay it any time up until that day.
Do you pay the schools in 2 installments, too, or do you owe them all the
money? We have to pay them every month.
Every month. You have to pay a pro rata share every month, so...
Whatever we collect goes out the 5th of the next month, then April, whatever outstanding on the warrant goes out.
So you provide their cash flow.
Yeah, you're the flow.
Just the way we provide you yours.
Huh?
I don't know what you...
So
you pay them whatever you received in September? In September?
In September, what we collect in October. Every single month, okay, we pay them everything we collect on their behalf.
Is that all the receivers do that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's the
charter.
Dave, you wanted to respond to one point. Oh, sorry, you hadn't finished.
One last thing, if you would.
Yeah, sure.
With new owners, the Receivers Association for 4 years approached, when I was president and another young lady from Austin was president, we came to you because your charter is so outdated it needs help. Mm. We couldn't get it past the doors. We worked with the Assessors Association to take a look at it. You have loopholes that are beyond loopholes, but more importantly, it's just plain old outdated. And we saw needs as receivers that we attempted to bring to you folks and got nowhere. But there were two things we really pushed, and some of this would cover your new homeowners. What we had asked was for the Bar Association, or for it to be changed, so that the attorneys at closing need to provide this information. Then everybody gets it. Then it's how long is it from the county to the local people for us to update our records? Do it at closing so that they have it in their hand when they walk out. And then everybody is covered.
So they have one at the closing, the information on taxes?
Absolutely. Right. And as it is now, they're supposed to be handing out the name and the address of the tax receivers. That's state law.
They don't.
Most of them are not doing it. And we're carrying this kind of a conversation because of it.
I've never heard that.
And you had another point.
Okay. And last but not least, you do feel badly for the people who are having problems paying them. But we're all in that boat at this time. It's not just one or two people. Nobody's getting their refunds from the state. So how do we take care of everybody? I don't know how else to say it to you. I feel bad for all of them, but I also feel bad for the rest of us who are making it work. We can't carry everybody for every little reason. Things happen. People die. People lose their jobs. I understand now there's more of it, so again, we're revisiting this, because we visited this about 8 years ago. Because I know I addressed you folks at a hearing. So it's not the first time. The economy is different, and yes, that's why we all feel bad. Rightly so. But we have to protect all our people, and everybody is hurting. So all I ask is that you be compassionate and be polite, but don't sell the rest of us out.
Can I ask a question? How many people pay late in each one of your communities? Do you know? And how many of them never pay?
Last year I had 75
leads. You're a Lewisburg?
Yes. Out of 5,800,
and
13 to be exact, I had
74. And how many did have paid late?
How many paid late?
Because this law would not affect the liens. I mean, anybody who doesn't pay.
Right now, my school.
This is only a 2 month.
I'm 695,000 short on my school.
Oof. Mm.
So the town will have to pay that.
But you have any idea how many people paid late?
How many? That would be in numbers.
We had about 300, and now we have about half of that. They paid from February 1st to now.
So about 150 people paid the penalties for whatever reason.
And that goes to our.
And the other 150 people, like Dave said, you'll have to chase forever.
I'll send another letter out on May 1st, and the. When they know that it would be filed at the county, they pay it. The 11th hour, they're there, and the last minute. They'll be like, that's their fear.
I have a sense that a lot of this is different communities, too.
I want Dave to respond to that one point.
I wanted to say, if we have to depend upon us not collecting taxes to balance the budget, we're in trouble, number one. Number two, if I ever collected 100% of the taxes, would Greenberg be in trouble because they're expecting me not to? You know, that's one way of looking at this. I think there's concern about getting the money in coffers. And again, Greenberg has a lot of diversity. We have a lot of blue collar, a lot of middle class and lower middle class people living there, which some of the northern suburbs may not have as many of. I don't know. But I will say one thing. Greenberg does not have a slush fund. You cannot believe everything you read in the paper. So that was a total lie. A total lie. If you go on a Greenberg website, you will find the name of everyone who has overpaid. But many of them have not overpaid. And I'll tell you why they haven't overpaid. Because banks pay on wrong accounts. Because we have to use what's called a lot box. With 29,000 accounts, most of them paying the last week of the collection, I have no choice but to utilize a bank where if you send it to the bank, they scan your bill, they put it in the bank, and they report it to me. I get a $24 million take the last week of collection. I get annually 1% or less of monies that are not accounted for. So out of $500 million, I may have a million not accounted for. It looks like a lot of money. It would be if I had it in my bank account. However, it's not a slush fund. That money is not being used by Greenberg, nor could it be used by Greenberg if Greenberg did not get that extra penalty money. That money cannot be used. So number one, it's not a slush fund. Number two, we're not hiding anything. And number three, in order to save our taxpayers' money, I have one of the smallest offices for permanent staff. I have two full-time people. Why? Because instead of hiring a third or fourth person and semi-retiring, I hire part-time people who are not getting pensions, who are not getting medical benefits. And what we're doing is we're saving a tremendous amount of money by doing that for the people in Greenberg. I'm still concerned about the people who do not have the money. And somebody said, you got 5 months to pay, 6 months to pay. Not if you're living month by month. You have jobs. You have money in the bank. If you're living month by month, you just don't have the money to pay 5 months in advance or 4 months in advance or 3 months in advance. So, but as far as the slush fund is concerned, there isn't one. It's open, it's on the internet, and that money cannot be touched by Greenberg if I collect no monies in taxes next year.
Mr. Chairman, what I'm concerned about is I'm hearing very different communities. And I'm wondering if there is a possibility, if we want to go this way, of doing an option, allowing the local communities to opt in if they want to do this, rather than a mandatory. Because I'm in Greenberg, it is a very diverse community. And I'm concerned about, particularly about those circumstances where this is a mistake or where something happens. You know, I'm an attorney who does closings, and I have seen, I discuss with people all the time, you know, when their taxes are due, et cetera. But if you don't have the bill, and if people are buying a house for the first time and coming from New York City, which we get a lot of, they don't understand what's going on. I mean, it's sometimes funny, you know. I mean, you guys probably have the septic systems. You know, they never know that they have to clean the septic system.
Yes.
But it's
I just think that this issue right now is not ripe for any vote. I mean, as we have a big difference of opinion on all sides. I think some more homework has to be done. Tom just threw out another possibility. Let him research that. But I don't think we're going to solve this today. You know, rather than have...
Well, I don't think we intended to solve it.
Well, I don't know what question. There's three choices here. We either decide to move forward with this, and I think there's a strong feeling that we're not, and unless I'm wrong, please speak
no,
up.
No, I'll tell you right now.
Two, we are going to go. We are not going to go forward with it. Or it warrants further discussion.
I don't hope that.
Who thinks it warrants further discussion?
I'd like to see discussion.
Let me finish.
Okay.
Who thinks it warrants further discussion?
By the legislative deference, if legislative body wants to go back to the drawing board and do this,
that's
I'm okay
then
with
he can
that.
Bring it back.
Bring it
but,
back.
But
bring,
let's
yeah.
decide what we're doing with this proposal, if people are ready to do that.
I'm not prepared to vote on this.
This is not opt-in, this is mandatory, right, Tom?
This one is just mandatory. Changing the schedules, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anybody else?
I'm not prepared.
No, I'm not for it.
All right. So we're not going
to. Can we ask the county attorney to check to see if there's a possibility of doing this on an optional basis?
The county attorney's here. Do you have any comments on this proposed legislation?
We have a few.
All right, let's hear them.
One of the things that, as I think the board already knows, we've always had a little concern about making any changes to our Westchester County tax law.
Can everybody hear?
This is why we never addressed your issues.
The table. Always taken the position,
can you go up to the table? I think people are having a problem following you from that distance.
I'm under the discriminant domain.
We're getting to eminent domain in 5 minutes.
Receive. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You know, I also would appreciate it if you could get us a list of the issues you think we need to address in our tax code, since you're the people that deal with it.
I
know this might have been come up in the past, but we're certainly willing to consider issues that you think we need to address.
We appreciate the help.
Okay.
Thank you
for coming, and thank you for the time you spent to give us comments. Don't leave. It's going to get more interesting after this.
John, just one other question. Are there any individuals here to address this issue?
Anybody else? Let's hear from the county attorney.
Okay, so what I was saying, one of our concerns has always been to make any changes to our tax law, because we have special status in the way we collect, the way we are able to have our penalties, and how that has affected us. Specifically, with respect to this particular provision, which is Article 11 of the RPTL, there is a section that relates to the application of this law.
Is that the section that allows it to happen in two installments?
No, actually, this section is the one that allows Westchester County to have its own law,
which
predates. Which
where we don't collect, the
towns collect, right.
And we're guaranteed on that.
Right, I got it.
We like that.
Yes, we like that.
We like that a lot.
As a young city councilman, I'm going to get
started. Sorry, exactly.
So believe Bob, Eddie, baby, don't forget that.
Go ahead, Lily.
Now, this particular law section, 1104, specifically states that the RPTL supersedes any inconsistent law to the contrary.
Right.
Except for those counties which have filed with the state by 1994 its local law.
Right.
This is why you always make me nervous when you're trying to
Because if we change it now, it's not on file.
An argument can be made that if we change it now, that's a problem. Yeah. Which is why the few times when we have done any changes, they've always been completely consistent with New York State law. So that there would be no argument there. You actually made a very interesting point in your new proposal, which made me a little bit happier, because assuming that the board did not want to take into the consideration that you shouldn't be amending it, you wanted to have a different proposal, the way that the state law arguably reads is it usually offers the municipality that is actually doing the collection the option of choosing which way it wants to go, whether or not it wants to collect the lower interest or not.
So it allows the municipality to choose the penalty?
It allows them to choose
to decide
with respect to the two installments of school taxes.
Yeah.
It allows, it's interesting because it refers to it as the county, but which allows it to choose between that 12%, which is the way we currently have, and this new
so it sounds like an opt-in would be consistent with the way you read state law.
You talk to me.
Well, except that another argument could be made that the state law is also a little different, because the provisions in the state law relating to this particular aspect really is speaking more toward counties that are the ones collecting the fees. But I think, you know, I think you can arguably read it in a couple of different ways. But let me just pull that section.
Well, rather than going into the details now, Mr. Chairman, can I suggest that we delay the conversation and we see if we can do an opt-in provision?
Okay. So
it sounds like there is a serious interest in Greenberg, and if you look at the number of parcels, I mean, it's close to 30,000 parcels, which is almost as many as the number of parcels we had opposing it, in effect. So I would like to see if there's some way we can work something out for this community. Well, if you think about it, the town of Greenberg has six different municipalities, seven municipalities that they're working with. Okay, each one of them is different, and this one receiver is working on behalf of seven municipalities.
Good. Let Tom go back and work on this.
Every receiver represents three municipalities, so let's not get crazy.
Well, control over the town of Harrison.
Hi.
I just have one comment. The minute you make something voluntary, you're automatically putting pressure on everybody else who said no.
Right.
Now, what's going to happen is you're going to put it out there and you're going to say, well, Greenberg's doing it. And then all of our constituents are coming to us and they're going to put pressure on our boards and they're going to be banging at the door and saying, why are you not doing it?
This sounds to me like a very small number of people that we're dealing with here.
Oh, no.
Well,
all right.
Remember, though, you're saying it Well, the town is not lowering it.
Why don't we save this debate? Let Tom come with a new proposal.
Let me wrap, I will wrap some up. We are not moving forward on the proposal as currently made by Legislator Abinanti. The ball is in your court if you want to come back with another proposal. And if you want any assistance from the county attorney to research whether it can be done on an optional basis, you could do that. We're not discussing the option now unless we know more, but we've heard almost both sides of that issue. And we'll invite, if we do consider this again as an optional measure, we'll certainly invite all of you back in to hear your thoughts on that. But that position, that point is very well taken that, you know, once you open the door, there might be political pressure on communities that don't want to adopt this.
Well said, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, but Mr. Chairman, on that point, so what? That's what they're elected to do.
Well, we'll see.
I mean, that's what the town boards in those communities are elected to do.
Okay.
To make those decisions.
Thank you. Next topic, probably more controversial, eminent domain.
Less controversial. Yeah. There's a huge consensus building on this.
But equally
let's say to Harkin has endorsed it. He's moving the ball forward in victory. Towards victory.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, John. John, quickie for you. I really need to start environment right at 3:30. I really have to today.
I'll give him that one.
Okay. Legislator Mesano.
Yes, sir.
Can we have the rest of the committee here, please? We have speakers. We have another meeting. Mr. Abinanti is left the room. He's your co-sponsor, so you're the one.
Now I have Legislator Harkin as my co-sponsor.
Okay.
I think he can line up more votes.
No comment, public.
Do you want to try to see Judy and Bill and Supervisor? We'll see him.
You open-minded on that. But John, can we?
You want to start?
Well, I think what we could do here today. Let me suggest to you. Is the county attorney, we asked them to go do some research. Why don't we start with them and then have a couple of our speakers. Is that all right?
Well, right. Thanks for coming. Thanks. Where is our county attorney? Oh, yeah. Could you come up? You're first on the hot seat today.
Cities don't even keep the return of all of them to school.
No, that's very helpful.
We get battered by both industrial and residential bills who usually pay on time, but you're in the middle of a snowstorm, we have something unusual that happens, and we're paying the tax back to the date of the levy, the penalty, not the Saturday. And ours is different. It's an interest rate by day. It's not it's the same interest rate no matter whether you're 7 days late or 8 days, 7 weeks late. That's the calculation of those bad debts.
I see both sides. Deciding how we make financial decisions. Maybe our MA can do that. The other side, what's the contribution? It's totally apprehensive. There's no way we can decide how we make contributions logically on a political basis. The policy decision is not. Doesn't make that anything they want. Without the financial contribution account,
for parents, that is no admission of guilt.
What I'm saying is the cities would
have
the thing is, it's not in our budget. We
hand
it all over to school districts. We have to talk a different issue.
I know, but
the
piece of it, whether it's a
new
project,
oh, yeah. So
if he's got a 2% no pen rate, $300 billion to less than $1 million.
That's fine.
He's got to come up. Not me, kiddo.
Okay, topic number two. We have 45 minutes, and I'm sure we're not going to finish it today, but at least we can get deeply into it. We're missing a few legislators, but we're not going to hold things up. At Legislator Mezzano's request, which was a very well-taken one, which I adopt, we will ask the county attorney to comment. We had some questions about certain sections of the general municipal home rule law and how it affects eminent domain. So can you address those, please? And we have a memo, I think, at least I got a copy of. which has been distributed.
No, no, those are, that's the memo that you got with respect to the charter revisions.
Right.
Okay. Okay, let me just say that you had asked us to look into these questions, and we're still, we haven't completed our review yet. We're still in the process. We should complete it shortly.
And you're looking at the question of the ability of the county, of the Board of Legislators to alter or change the county's authority with respect to eminent domain.
That's the questions that were asked regarding eminent domain.
Yeah, including things like the private cause of action under the current
clause. Well, that was the big thing, the private clause.
So you want to, go ahead.
Tell us what you found.
The floor is yours.
But you can't say.
No, don't interrupt.
We'll restrain Mr. Maison. Ms. Williams is there for a reason.
Muzzle.
He sat next to me. I didn't sit there.
You don't want to sit with me?
I have no problem.
Go ahead, please.
Okay. Well, one of your first questions that you had asked is, was the impact of Municipal Home Rule Law Section 24.2D and 34.3G with respect to eminent domain?
Right.
The interesting thing about this, and you need to go back a little bit, is to get a little bit of history and the connection to these sections. Municipal Home Rule Law Section 24.2D was originally adopted in 1963. This was after Westchester County had its its laws relating to eminent domain and the procedures set forth in our laws in Westchester County. Municipal Home Rule Law, as you know, allows Westchester County and other counties throughout the state the ability to change its laws under certain circumstances without having to go back to the state legislature. Mm. One of the things that was included in Municipal Home Rule Law back in 1963 was the ability to have a permissive referendum with respect to local laws concerning the issue of condemnation, which is another word for eminent domain. Interestingly enough, though, the section relating to the eminent domain procedure law and that whole volume was pretty much established in 1977.
Right.
At that time, the sections of the eminent procedure law specifically state, one section, 101, that it is the purpose of this law to provide the exclusive procedure by which property shall be acquired by the exercise of the power of eminent domain in the state of New York. In addition, Section 104 of the eminent domain law specifically states that its applicability, the eminent domain procedure law shall be uniformly applied to any and all acquisitions by eminent domain of real property within the state of New York. This would seem to be clear language that the provisions of the eminent domain law supersedes our provisions in our charter with respect to the eminent domain procedure law. In addition, it should be noted that that other section of Municipal Home Rule Law, that 34.3G, was enacted subsequently after the enactment of the Eminent Domain Procedure Act law.
So after 77.
After 77. In fact, it wasn't until 1988 that section was changed. And although that provision of the Municipal Home Rule Law Section 34.3G originally stated condemnation, it has now been specifically amended to relate to the eminent domain procedure law. And what that section says, 34 of the Municipal Home Rule Law, is that says a county charter or charter law shall not contain provisions relating to the eminent domain procedure law. So given that legislative history, I would think there would be a very strong argument that, to the extent that we try to limit eminent domain procedure in any way, shape, or form, that we are preempted by a state.
But is the proposal that's being made seeking to, in any way, change the procedure for eminent domain?
I believe there are sections of the provisions of it. I think we still are working in connection with doing the complete analysis of it, but we believe that there are certain provisions of the eminent domain law of this proposed local law, which may be in conflict with that provision, and we're still working out the ins and outs of that.
So there's a threshold issue of the extent to which we have the power to change the eminent domain procedure in the county. But you know, we kind of got that first. But
either Legislative Messina or Liz Amanati, can you summarize what you're proposing so we have...
You want to do it?
Well, no.
I mean, let's do it real quickly.
Yeah,
number
it's
one,
not that,
that
complicated.
That
so,
the county of
so
Westchester
hears it.
Will not use its power of eminent domain to take private property for private use the way we define it in our law. We won't use our eminent domain power. And number two, to take private property for private use. And number two, should a local government take private property for private use in their own development scheme, the county government will not be a partner with them and contribute funds to that economic development.
Right. Yeah. And then you have to think about housing.
Let me thank you. I think Bill's about to help me out. Both of those two still could happen. It just requires a two-thirds vote of the legislature. It's not an absolute ban. It's just a two-thirds vote of the legislature.
And there's one other item that they are looking at, and that's
the
private right of action of an individual to sue to stop an eminent domain proceeding.
Well, can I amend that? He's not completely accurate.
Okay.
In his analysis
of the law.
Just on the law. Well,
but let's hear.
I made a mistake. I'm happy for my friend.
I'm sorry.
Help me out.
I'm sure
Legislator Rogowski, you have a.
In his description of the two thirds vote, it still requires that even for two thirds, that it's only to be used for a public use, as defined in this local law. So
right.
The eminent domain, even if passed by two thirds, is limited to the definition of public use. With that,
that's an interesting distinction. I was never quite sure of that. It's a thing I actually would like to talk out with everyone.
Yeah, because that's a lot of discussion.
That's a fine line on that.
A lot of, right. We are, this law, that's defined by the Supreme Court, other bodies, saying this legislation attempts to define public use and then limits the two-thirds to have eminent domain
to
limited to our definition of public use.
Or to affordable housing development.
Well, which is another issue.
Right.
Right. But just to be clear,
Legislator Burt.
If what we do is not put in the form of a law, but is put in the form of an act, and which says that the executive branch shall not participate in, and I'm thinking of the IDA in this situation, which is where the example that I draw my opposition to this bill comes from. If we essentially forbid the executive from participating or moving anything forward that uses eminent domain under the strictures that Jim and Tom have made, would that fall afoul of what you see in the state law? We set it up just as a policy, not as a law.
Well, one of the first things we would have to look at, I mean, it's a new issue, so one of the first things we have to look at is whether or not there's anything specifically in the laws of Westchester County which arguably address that issue. To the extent that that is already addressed and that has occurred or has been enacted by a local law, then such a thing could not be changed by act. It would have to be done through legislative equivalency.
Okay. I'm just thinking, if Tom or Jim were elected as the county executive, for example, and they said, that's it, I won this election, I'm going to say we're not going to do this anymore. The question would be then where their personal opinion would run afoul of the law, would be the point that I would be trying to make here.
An act is legislation that everybody has to follow, the same as a local law.
But if we structure that simply to the executive, I don't know. Maybe I'm overreaching here, but I'm trying to find out whether or not
this law talks about the county of Westchester, which includes the board and the county executive.
I guess I'm reaching too far there, but I'm trying to find a way to take it back to the law, because the law part, I think you've pretty much nailed
it. You can do a resolution, then.
A resolution, then. Okay, but that wouldn't be binding on the executive office.
That's correct.
So it looks like it's going to be either a law or nothing, if assuming that you all can see your way clear to saying we can do that.
Yeah, assuming
okay.
You can do it.
Well, there's no requirement to exercise eminent domain.
No, I'm just saying.
We're looking for the opposite.
Either we leave it alone or we go forward with something else.
The policy driving this is that there may be eminent domain without the Board of Legislators being involved in it.
Sure, by the municipalities.
By the municipalities, or by the county executive, or after we appropriate monies. And so by making it a local law, it's mandatory that our monies cannot be used for that purpose, and it's a local law because it affects the local governments. So they're on notice as well that they can't use our monies if they're going to go forward with an eminent domain in their projects. Secondly, the private right of action has to be by local law. You can't do that by an act. And thirdly, the concept of running afoul of the state law, I think is misplaced. That's dealing with the rights of landowners. We're not talking about the rights of landowners here. We're only talking about the action by the government itself, by the county government. And we're not giving anybody any procedural rights. Now, I guess you could argue that the private right of action does, but that's not about eminent domain. That's about whether the county follows its own law. And this private right of action is an attempt to give somebody the right to enforce county law, and consistent with this whole concept that either you can do it or you can't do it. And it is a bit of a stretch from what we've done before, but I think there are other cases where we put in a private right of action. I didn't dream up this language. Yeah. I'm trying to remember
you've stuck an ADC type law in it?
Huh? No, we've done it
before. Tom did sneak it in on something else I can't remember in the last 15 years.
Wow. Yeah, I did do it.
I think it was parcel Q.
Was it on parcel Q? And lastly, I think Mr. Mezano, Mr.
Legislative Harkin was next on the
I think Mr. Wigowski is correct in his interpretation that this is a ban on the use of eminent domain or participation in a project with eminent domain. But let's face it, the Board of Legislators, you know, this is a two-thirds vote. You can always, if you wanted to, you can always make an exception to the law in some case where it's so horrendous that you really need to do this. And the last point is, and I'd like to later have a discussion on the issue of public use, because that's what this is all about. The question of what is a public use versus a public benefit. And if you look at our definition of public use, it is quite broad. So it does overlap into that area.
Broader than we even wanted to. We broadened our definition after discussion with our colleagues in communities.
Yeah, we've been through this several times. We put in a statute which was much, much leaner, and then we had several conversations when Legislator
Seeking
Cousins...
Seeking consensus. Tom and I are bridge builders.
Right.
Yeah.
When Legislator Cousins was the chair
of
the... I can give you... I have the back versions, and you will see it has evolved.
Okay.
And so this is the final version. This is probably about the third or fourth... Probably the third version.
Okay. Legislator Harkin...
Just so that the versions... And we had the same opinion.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did.
And yet they're still...
We don't agree with you.
We don't agree with you.
We don't agree with you.
Thanks. The question I have is, you know, the traditional sources of funding from the county obviously mostly go through the Board of Legislators, but the thing that I don't believe is covered by your bill, which you may want to consider, is the IDA, because that's, in a sense, a county source of funding that could still contribute to an eminent domain
project.
That's
where we thought we were preempted.
Yeah, I thought that is covered.
That's the one place we agreed we were preempted.
All right, so you are preempted.
Yeah, I think this
well, can I comment on that? What we did was we used the definition of Westchester County government, which is very broad. All of its departments, agencies, instrumentalities, and all persons acting under its auspices or exercising its powers, including the county executive and all or each of the members of the Board of Legislators. Now, I'm not ready to concede that we're preempted with the IDA.
I think we probably are.
But that's for a future determination. We would like to see it include the IDA.
Well, I think,
but
I
don't.
Think,
but
wait,
that's not. We don't need to have that argument now.
Well, I think we absolutely do.
I think we'd have to stay,
Peter. And that's part of it,
Peter. I think we'd have to change.
I mean, I'm trying to strengthen your law.
Yeah, no, Peter. I think I think this will help you. I think what may have to be if we want to do what you just said, and I do. Because I don't know, I disagree with Tom, but I don't think our law can do this.
Well, I'm just
saying we
should clarify
the this. The county, obviously, as everyone knows, our county law relating to the IDA is state law.
Yeah.
We could probably add a change into that or a whole rule message to Albany. That's something we could talk about. I mean,
or we could require.
I'm more than open to do that.
When people come before us for appointment to the IDA, we can ask them, "Would you follow the law? Will you pledge to follow the law that we've passed for all other parts of Westchester County?"
Right.
Well, okay. That's where I came up.
That's
with
a good point, Peter. That's a very good point.
Right. I guess my point is we need to quantify where we are with this, as opposed to your point that we'll have that argument down the road, i.e., someone's going to sue or it's going to be a test case. I think that's important to the central premise of what we're trying to do, and we need to quantify that.
We have a few speakers.
I just make two comments quick. Number one, Peter makes a great point about the IDA, because I want to dovetail it to my second point. My first point is this. The issue of preemption, I believe, can only deal with the piece of the law we say Westchester will not use its power of eminent domain to take private property for private use. We can have this debate. I'm willing to have that debate. I'm not quite sure I agree with them, but it's an intellectual debate we need to have. I don't think there's a debate on the second piece, where we decide how we're spending our money. That's not part of the eminent domain procedure law in any way, shape, or form. That is not preempted. I've told you this for 6 years now. I don't even think there's a, frankly, I don't think there's a legal argument that we are preempted on how we decide. That's a spending mechanism. It has absolutely nothing to do with the eminent domain procedure law.
It's policy.
It's a policy. Thank you. That's exactly right. So,
but so is eminent domain. I don't even see where that's covered.
Okay. Well, listen, I'm what my point is. I think
if
they raised...
say people had 60 days to challenge an eminent domain, then that's...
I'm just trying to be fair to the county attorney. Okay. I think they raise an issue we need to look at closely on whether we're preempted on that piece. But the second piece of the law dealing with how we decide, putting a bright line test on that we will not spend our county tax dollars on projects that local governments use eminent domain, I don't believe that's covered by preemption at all. I don't even think there's a logical argument for that. And number two, it was the second piece is that to dovetail Peter's point. Maybe on that first part, which we, if we decide at some point, if we as a team decide that we are preempted on the first piece, maybe that's something we can also do a home rule on in Albany. If we're also going to do the IDA, maybe we do a double home rule and get us permission to do this under state law. We can work with our state legislators. That should be on the table as well.
Okay, thanks. We have three speakers who have listed to speak, and I want to make sure we give them enough time to speak. Just want to make one comment and reaction. I think you really have to, this is to account to Linda and Stacey. Yeah, I think you really have to focus on what the eminent domain procedure law says and what this law does. Because this law, the first part says, the Westchester County government is prohibited from using its powers of eminent domain to contend private property for private use. I think that's black letter law. The question is how you define private private use and public use, and whether we have the leeway to, under the eminent domain procedure law, to fashion our own definition. And the real issue here is public use versus public purpose.
Correct.
At the bottom line.
That's what I said. That's where the discussion has to take place.
And because I really wonder if there's preemption, but it is a legitimate issue. We do have to look at it very closely. So with that...
can I just add one more thing, just so that you're all aware? Let's assume by some weird chance that we're not preempted. This law would still require a mandatory referendum.
Yeah, under the municipal home rule.
Mandatory, mandatory referendum.
Mandatory.
That's
reason,
under 24.
The reason it would be mandatory is because you would be binding future boards as to the way they are going to utilize
it. And that's under the municipal's future board.
Believe me, I can't wait for this referendum because about 90% of the people in the county are going to vote for it.
That's
trust me.
25-2D?
This is an easy one.
2D?
This is a slam dunk referendum.
I believe it's even under our section of the charter.
Under our charter, right, okay.
Have you ever seen polling on this issue? It's 80 to 90% in favor of these kinds of limits.
We are
fortunate to have here as a speaker, I hope he's still here, and I thank him for his patience, Michael Rickon. Michael Rickon here? Come on up. Thank you for your patience. We are hoping you can enlighten us here, since you're a special consultant to the New York State Commission on Eminent Domain, so I think we're lucky we have an expert here. And then Albert Annunziata, a frequent visitor to our meetings. We always enjoy hearing Albert's comments. You're listed as a potential speaker.
I'm listening, and I may comment at
okay.
some point.
And then,
colleagues
and Mayor Foster. Where's Mayor Foster?
Very, very good.
Oh, right there. Okay.
Oh, John, we had one.
And would you like to speak?
That's fine.
John, we had next. You're next.
We had an added starter. Also, one other speaker that we invited today.
Okay, that's fine.
Deborah Cohen.
Oh, right, Deborah Cohen.
Deborah
and
Cohen.
Anyone else who wants to speak, we'll get to speak. But these are three people. That
okay, thanks.
Yes, Mr. Thank
first,
you for coming.
Thank you for inviting me to appear today. With the very last subject of your discussion, there's, in my opinion, no reason why Westchester can't adopt a legislation that pertains to restricting takings to public use. Other municipalities have their own codes, even though there is an eminent domain procedure law. The City of New York uses the administrative code, which sets forth the whole formula with respect to eminent domain. So it's something that...
So there is some room for local laws within the context of the...
And if you look at Judge Stevens's decision in the Kelo case, he very specifically stated that it's up to the states and municipalities to limit takings. A week ago, The Honorable John R. LaCava, Justice of the Supreme Court, rendered a decision in a condemnation case known as Didden and Bologna against the village of Porchester. I represented the claimants. The court awarded $3,062,000 plus about $600,000 in interest against the condemnor's pre-vesting offer of $975,000. The Didden Bologna case gained national outrage when the developer, GNS in Porchester, demanded $800,000 or 50% of a CVS lease deal Didden and Bologna had signed for their own property. Litigation followed after the developer told the owners that if they didn't pay, he would have that property condemned the next day. And when they said it was extortion and refused, he filed papers the very next day to condemn. The case proceeded in federal court to stop this condemnation. Eventually went before Justice Sotomayor when she sat on the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. In fact, after she affirmed the decision by the district court, which dissolved the injunction, she was questioned at the Senate confirmation hearings about how she could allow such abusive eminent domain practice to occur. Interesting enough.
Well, wouldn't the issue be, is there a federal question? In that case, why are they in federal court?
They were in federal court.
Was there a constitutional issue?
There was a constitutional issue, and the constitutional issue was this a public use? As compared to public purpose.
Right. So it was a Fifth Amendment claim.
Interesting enough, and there were civil rights cases as well with the extortion. Judge LaCava said something very interesting in his 23-page decision. He talks about Porchester and states the project was planned to take place in phases, and as development occurred in one phase, the village would acquire land through the power of eminent domain for the next phase. During land acquisitions for the second phase, displaced tenants, businesses, and private landowners began to raise many legal issues, including allegations that GNS was using illegal tactics in order to obtain these parties' agreement to settle without just compensation. These included the undertaking of wrongful evictions, the theft of mail, threats, and property damage. So, it was very interesting that he put that into decision. I just briefed at this point the legal issues with compensation. But no condemnation proceeding in New York State's history has been more abusive to property owners, tenants, and residents than the Porchester proceeding. I've been practicing eminent domain law for 41 years now. I started off as an assistant corporation counsel for the city of New York. I clerked for a judge, and then I've been in private practice. My law firm was started in 1923, and all we do is eminent domain. We don't do tax certiorari cases, although I was interested in the previous hearing. I also represent condemning authorities. I represent the town of East Hampton, the town of Southampton, the town of Southold. I've represented Pelham, and I was involved in the Sanborn Avenue litigation. I've been consulted by the town of Greenberg on a proposed case. But no proceeding like Porchester ever had as many published articles. There were at least 8 different articles in the New York Times detailing the abuse. No condemnation proceeding ever had as much litigation as Porchester, because of the extremely low and unfair appraisals by the village's appraisers. Attorneys representing claimants were forced to litigate most of the claims filed. Federal litigation brought by a public litigation group, the Institute for Justice, and I know that they presented written testimony for this committee, in the Brody versus Village of Porchester case, wound up with the Second Circuit striking and invalidating the notice requirements of New York's eminent domain procedure law as being inviolative of due process requirements. I represented some 37 property owners and tenants in Dorchester. Nothing I've ever seen came close to the abuse. And the reason for this abuse was the developer's control of the entire proceeding. The developer determined how much to pay, when to settle, when to condemn. The control by the developer came from a ladder agreement, a land acquisition development agreement. That agreement effectively sold the village's power of eminent domain to the sponsor developer.
They outsourced their eminent domain power.
Absolutely. Only the developer made the decisions of what to do in that proceeding. My concern, especially, is something that this committee should consider, is what happens when the project goes bad? Who is going to pay the judgment? Who is going to pay the amount of money that might be awarded? I'm not sure GNS has the money to pay the balance that Judge LaCava just awarded. That sum will be an additional $3,250,000 with what one calculates in the interest of almost $600,000 because the taking was 6 years ago, and the requirement to reimburse legal and appraisal fees.
GNS has to pay that, or the Portchester?
Portchester is responsible.
The
under the latter agreement, they're supposed to reimburse, but what if they disappear? It's a separate LLC, and it's as good as it has as much money in the bank at the present time.
And the project itself is not owned by GNS?
The project is actually, it's kind of convoluted. The village of Portchester did the condemnation, then conveyed to the village of Portchester IDA, which then leased the property to GNS of Portchester LLC. But if there are no tenants that are paying rent, if the real estate market turns down, the village condemned the property, the village is responsible for payment. I have other situations, one of them in Rockland County with Havistraw, where I tried a case where our appraisal was $16 million and the village's appraisal was $1 million. Now, the property, we said, had a highest and best use of luxury condominiums. It was built into the harbor at Havistraw by Ginsburg. I understand, I have no personal information, that Ginsburg is in financial trouble. If I recover a judgment, I don't think Havistraw will be able to pay it. I don't think that the underlying agreement provides enough security for the local communities. The municipalities will be required to pay it because it's their power of eminent domain. Now, after Kelo versus City of New London was rendered by the United States Supreme Court, 43 states passed legislation restricting the taking of private property to turn over to a private developer. There isn't anyone in this room whose house is not worth more as a site for a Costco. This is what's been going on all over the country. 43 states have taken effective legislative action to stop this abuse. New York has been noticeably absent in passing legislation to stop eminent domain abuse. After Kelo, the New York State Bar Association impaneled a blue ribbon committee. They had hearings. They heard testimony, judges, law professors, prominent attorneys, everyone on every side appeared. The committee made recommendations through the New York State Legislature. The first recommendation was that a commission on eminent domain be impaneled to study the law. And as was said earlier, the law was enacted in 1977. It's long overdue for revision, just in the substantive law and the procedural things that have happened since then. It's old. It requires revision. Although there are several bills pending including bills by Senator Bill Perkins in the the Senate. Those bills are to eliminate some forms of the abuse, such as requiring a definition of blight, which is an amorphous definition.
That's
in
the Atlantic
eyes
Cards
of
case,
the beholder.
Right? That's the issue in the Atlantic Cards case.
Portchester.
Yes.
And IKEA too. Never
that's
saw
how
about
IKEA was going to be. That's how they
blight
gets
you into the
2/3 of the property in your show were good or better, and they called it a blighted neighborhood.
And that allows you
incredible.
To say it's public use to condemn the property and give it to a developer.
Has to be done in the 30s.
And don't let blight stand in the way if you want to condemn property, because the New York State Urban Development Corporation's enabling statute requires the finding of blight. But when they couldn't find blight, as in the expansion for the New York Stock Exchange, they created legislation exempting the requirement to find blight so that they could go ahead and condemn the property. Because it's difficult to blight a Trump luxury building.
Yes.
But they enabled to do it. They passed the legislation. It was challenged in a case called Matter of Fisher. And then someone woke up and said, you know what, we don't need a bigger stock exchange. We really need a smaller one. But by that time, it cost the taxpayers $123 million in expenses and payments and rent and legal fees. It's totally wrong to take someone's property to turn over to a private developer. I make my living based on the fees that I get in condemnation awards. But I have seen over the years the abuse and the unfairness in the compensation that is recovered by people whose property is taken. Mm-hmm. It's wrong. It should be restricted for true public uses. And before anyone is allowed to use the awesome power, and it is an awesome power of eminent domain, it should be restricted to public, true public use. Thank you.
Thank you.
I would just note, Mr. Chairman, that we don't use the word blight in our legislation.
Yes. Don't go. Stay there. I'm going to ask Mayor Forster to come up and give her comments.
Why don't you come as Kenny Thomas' point?
And then we'll answer.
That's why we tried to stay away from the procedure part of it. That's why we didn't get into things
and
like
Cohen.
We were avoiding getting into the procedures, and we weren't preempted.
So you can come up and sit, what, Ms. Cohen? Hi, Mayor. How you doing?
Okay.
Good. Now, you have enacted some local law in Peekskill that deals with eminent domain.
Right, and so I did bring
great, thank you.
It's free. Certainly, you are welcome to them.
Hmm?
And if you want, I can just give you a
please.
Little bit of background
sure.
about what
thank
we
you.
Were trying to do.
One,
I do want to applaud the county for trying to tackle this issue. It's certainly not an easy issue to tackle. And there's only 10 copies, so I don't know how many are available to the general public. But it's not an easy issue to tackle. And at a local municipal level, you are trying to still encourage economic development, and you do want to be able to work with private developers. But in our view, it was very important that everybody understood the rules of the road or the rules of engagement. And so as private developers came into the city, it was very clear to them up front what the local administration would be prepared to do and what they would not be prepared to do, so that all developers were treated equally. Some were not more favored than others, nor were some developers disadvantaged over others, but rather developed a restrictive use of our powers of eminent domain. I had some views on the county's legislation, but let me just take you very quickly how we ended up where we ended up, and realizing that at a local municipality that may be a little different than what you're looking at the county level. I did take note that I want to double check that this is applicable to our own IDA. I'm not sure, it raised an interesting point, so I'll double check that. But as you can imagine, in the small historic river cities, we are both favored with a lot of historic buildings, but we also have issues with negligent property owners for decades letting historic buildings deteriorate. And generally, the city would be able to step in when it became a total public hazard, in which case sometimes it was too late to really save the buildings. So when we were trying to deal with how to restrict our use of eminent domain, We wanted it to be very clear that we did not favor taking private property for private development. However, that didn't mean that we would allow historic buildings to basically get demolished through neglect. And we wanted to be able to create some, hopefully, bright lines, so when you're writing legal language, it's never really a bright line, there's a lot of gray. But we were trying to develop some bright lines in terms of things that we believe would be appropriate uses of our powers. We took a crack at defining blight. It's not an easy thing to define. We argued about whether it's a hands or oars between each of the clauses. But where we would take private property is if, in fact, it had not been, if it had been abandoned, if it had not been used legally within its COO for at least the two preceding years, if it suffered from signs of blight, as we listed there, if it was a public nuisance. But we did it in terms of the things we were protecting, as opposed to in the negative, because we've been trying to write positive legislation as opposed to punitive legislation. So what we do say is that we would not invoke the power of eminent domain for the sole purpose of economic development on any property which is benefited by a valid and subsisting certificate of occupancy, has not been used for any purpose other than that permitted by the certificate of occupancy during the two preceding year, has not been vacant for more than 2 years immediately preceding the council's determination, has not been determined by the common council to be a blight on the neighborhood, and possesses no hazard or danger to the public health, safety, or welfare.
And then you define blight with respect to four, define blight above in the definition.
Right. And so what we tried to do is enumerate five hoops that you would need to get through before you took private development, because in our view, if you take a historic deteriorating building, unless the city is restoring it, if you sell it to somebody else to restore, that's economic development. And so in looking at that, many, many things we do are economic development. And so it would be very hard to say saving historic buildings are not economic development. It really is. But rather put steps in place to say these are the things, if you fail all these tests, then not that the city is on a shopping spree, but if you fail all these tests and buildings really become a hazard and a public nuisance, the city will invoke its use of eminent domain. But generally, we are not using it for private development. We're trying to make that very clear, because we're also trying to encourage existing property owners to reinvest in buildings, and we're doing that through Main Street grant programs, loan programs, deferred loan programs, a number of programs to actually encourage reinvestment. It's hard to do that if people are afraid that, you know, one block over is a real mess and what's going to go on there. The city, though, will use eminent domain to acquire property to build a firehouse.
Right. For public use.
Because it is public use. I'm not clear how clear state law is on the difference between public use and public benefit. But I do think to the extent that the county could draw a brighter line, you know, in your view, for county funding for what's public use versus public benefit would be helpful. In terms of what you're proposing...
And you have a supermajority, by the way, too.
We do have a supermajority. If you're going to use it, we just think that's important. It can't be a simple majority. But I did want to comment on the county law, because I do take exception that if you're not going to use eminent domain for private use and private development, whether that private development has market-rate housing or affordable housing, I wouldn't create an exception for affordable housing. It is still a private use. Not anybody can live in affordable housing. So it's not the same as building a park or a firehouse or a school. And most local municipalities, maybe I'll just speak for the city of Peekskill and not for all, but as hard as we work to develop a trusting relationship with our developers, we try to work to develop a trusting relationship with the county, and to the extent that public agencies, it can be interpreted to be a very broad array of county initiatives, it still creates a level of unease at the local municipality level that the county would still use eminent domain for, quote, you know, county public agencies, what could those mean? And so we always raise, you know, what gets raised a lot in our neck of the woods is whether or not the county would use eminent domain to build a homeless shelter. Especially if you're going to exempt out affordable housing, people start to speculate as to what other, quote, public agencies could be there. So to the extent you could offer more clarity around what you envision by public agencies. If the language was tailored to kind of sweep up IDAs and public authorities, well, maybe that's a public authority and not a public agency.
Thanks.
So that's
good point.
Just creates...
That's helpful. That's a good point.
So you think we're not encompassing enough in this legislation?
No, I think
that
actually...
we're actually too narrow.
No.
No, it's just that one section.
What I said is allowing affordable housing is, you shouldn't make affordable housing
an exception
to your restriction.
To the rest of
right, but in addition to that, oh, okay, so it was just directed towards that, it wasn't direct, okay, I understand.
And to clarify what you mean by public agencies.
Right.
You know, the possession, occupation, or employment of a parcel of land by the general public, I think I get it, or by public agencies. Well, I don't know what that means.
It's a good point.
Yeah.
It could still be allowing a fairly broad use under your definition of public use.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank
good.
You. Thanks a lot, Mayor. Thanks for coming and sharing your
work. That's very helpful, yes.
I'm very impressed with your law, Mayor. It's a really forethinking community. I think you're the only one in Westchester that has such a law, so I'm pretty impressed with that.
I think the town of Yorktown adopted something. We spent about 2 years going back and forth with our own corporation council.
And did your corporation council confirm this isn't preempted by the eminent domain procedure law?
Well, it doesn't change the procedural law. Use
right,
the procedural law, you still have to give notice,
right.
You still have to pay compensation, you still have the
that's
whole process.
Yeah.
We're not touching
but they
procedure.
Researched that,
what
I'm
we're
sure.
What we're making very clear is where we're restricting our use to, you know, declare a property in play.
Right.
Well, that's a good point, John. You know why? Because if they're not preempted, we're certainly not preempted.
Right. Ms. Cohen, thank you very much for coming, Mayor. Well,
I'm happy actually to follow the mayor because she actually has put in very concrete terms what I am more theoretical terms I'm about to try to lay out as a reason why actually a tightening of the eminent domain law could be a catalyst to have municipalities try to engage in a more creative, inclusive development process as she's describing.
Ms. Cohen, you just tell us your affiliation.
Yes, I'm going to.
Okay,
just to
you were just following up there. Thanks.
Give that bridge to the mayor.
Thanks. Thank you.
My name is Deborah Cohen, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to comment on this proposed legislation. I'm an attorney who has counseled and represented clients in New Rochelle, Porchester, Brooklyn, outside the county, and Yonkers, who were directly impacted by the exercise of eminent domain, and also as an adjunct professor of civil rights litigation at Pace Law School, this is a subject that I, like many of you, have tried to look at from a variety of perspectives. In 2005, the United States Supreme Court rendered its 5-4 decision in the case of Kelo versus the City of New London. And at the center of the Kelo decision is the Supreme Court's affirmation that legislatures should be afforded a broad latitude in determining what public needs justify the use of takings power. The court refused to adopt a bright-line rule that economic development does not qualify as public use. However, the court took the unusual step of emphasizing that nothing in their opinion precludes any state from placing further restrictions on its exercise of the takings power, and noted that many states had done so already. The court's explicit acknowledgement that the necessity and wisdom of using eminent domain to promote economic development was certainly a matter of legitimate public debate. And this was an implicit encouragement that such a debate take place. And so that's really why we're here. The polar positions of the debate are easy to identify. In one extreme, eminent domain is seen as a necessary tool to assemble large, comprehensively planned development sites, in what my kids would call air quotes, out of smaller, often underutilized or blighted properties whose owners will otherwise demand inflated prices. On the other extreme, eminent domain is characterized as a weapon wielded by powerful developers and government officials acting in concert to destroy the modest dreams of the little guy to achieve the ambitions of the big guys. These overly simplified heroes and villains stereotypes that too often envelop our public debates on difficult issues don't move us forward in grappling with the realities of why there is growing unease for how broadly the public use standard is being applied, and the reality that an almost insurmountable burden is now on property owners to demonstrate why their property should not be taken, rather than on government to demonstrate why it should.
The presumption should be on that the government has to establish.
Even with New York State's revised eminent domain laws improving the notice requirements to property owners, the playing field is still not level. Because once a property is targeted for taking, long before the property owner is aware of the imminent danger of eminent domain, they have already been shut out of a planning process involving their property that they have had no or little involvement in or ability to impact. It's already occurred. We should heed Justice Sandra Day O'Connor's warning in her dissent in the Kelo case that if government can take our property without meeting a burden of demonstrating that a public benefit is being directly achieved, that the property is a source of some social harm, we are left with, in O'Connor's words, the absurd argument that any single-family home that might be raised to make way for an apartment building, or any church that might be replaced with a retail store, or any small business that might be more lucrative if it were instead part of a national franchise, is inherently harmful to society and thus within government's power to condemn. Reforming eminent domain laws is not about impeding economic development. Rather, reform should be designed to require government officials, developers, and property owners to embrace new and improved approaches to the challenges we face in revitalizing communities where our populations and needs are growing while the availability of developable land is shrinking. The temptation to recycle privately owned property by putting it in the hands of those with the resources to turn it into something bigger and better is a recipe for abuse. Only through establishing clear guidelines that recognize, balance, and reconcile diverse and sometimes disparate economic and social interests within our communities can we become more comfortable that legislatures are exercising this power fairly, reasonably, and justly, and doing everything possible throughout the planning process to involve and support existing property owners' participation. This legislation is an attempt to heed Justice O'Connor's warning that we are on a path where no private property owner should feel immunized from the abuse of eminent domain. The legislation's clarification and narrowing of the definition of public use, the requirement that a two-third majority of the legislatures must find that eminent domain is needed to achieve a public use, and restrictions on the use of county resources for non-compliant projects will hopefully be a catalyst for improving how we approach redeveloping and revitalizing our communities in ways that are more inclusive, creative, and in the long run, I believe, will be more successful in meeting our changing needs.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Mr. Reichen and Ms. Cohen, if you can, yours is probably not typed up, but if you could submit it.
Deborah Cohen did, I'm passing it
but
over.
But we'd love to have both of your comments.
I'll be in the office tomorrow.
If you could, they were very valuable and something we
John Deborah is coming around the table.
We have one more speaker I think we have time for today.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to note that we also have a submission from the testament from the Institute.
I will talk about that when we come to the speakers. Thank you, because we have to move on to the next meeting.
Thank you. Richard Hyman, I'm a consultant to the Westchester County Housing Opportunity Commission.
Great.
I live in Portchester. I've been involved in urban renewal for 40 years. I'd like to have a long discussion, which I know you don't have time for.
But we're going to continue. This is not over today.
Just a few things. Justice O'Connor's warning was in the dissent, not in the majority. The current law, as the Supreme Court affirmed in Kelo, allows the taking of private property for a private use under certain conditions. So that is the law of the land. It certainly allows states to adjust that. But the current, everything that has been done in New Rochelle downtown, in White Plains downtown, and in Peekskill downtown as part of old urban renewal projects, current urban renewal projects are legal. I just want to address affordable housing, because I think that is something that you very generously put into this, but I think it doesn't go far enough for two reasons. First of all, affordable housing you need to be very careful with, because you know you have a settlement agreement, and any kind of restriction on the development of affordable housing is going to be looked at by HUD and by the monitor and the court very carefully, so I don't know that you really want to restrict affordable housing. To me, this does restrict affordable housing. Affordable housing is a public purpose. It was so defined in Berenson and Continental and Triglia versus Portland and all these cases. Affordable housing is a public purpose, and what you're saying is that it can go ahead with a two-thirds majority, but you're saying only for those projects by government agency or a not-for-profit corporation in partnership with a government agency. There are many affordable housing projects in this county that are done by private, for-profit developers who receive county funds, state funds, federal funds in order to make the project affordable. Whether it's Lula Riza in Portchester and Rybrook, or Wilder Balder in Cortland, or just across the street, Bank Street Common, that all these developments were done by private developers on their own, receiving public funds, but not in partnership with a government or a not-for-profit. And I think by so limiting it to having to be done by a government or an agency with a not-for-profit is going to make all those type of developments impossible. And one of the ways that the settlement is to be dealt with is through the use of inclusionary housing development. In fact, every, except for 12 municipalities in this county are going to have to redo their zoning ordinance if they want any county money to include an inclusionary housing statute in their zoning ordinance. Often that is done with no financing other than what they may get from the county or under the Housing Implementation Fund or the new homes on a proportion basis. If that is done in an area that is an urban renewal project and that had eminent domain used in order to acquire property, it would no longer be allowed. You would not be able to use county housing implementation funds or county CD funds or county new home land acquisition funds to assist that affordable housing in communities.
You mean for a private developer?
For a private developer. And that's done, I say, there's private developers do affordable housing all the time.
Do you know how many have been assisted by eminent domain?
Do I know? Well, the one Bank Street, I mean, it's part of the project that you're sitting in right now, which was assisted by eminent domain. This whole downtown White Plains is an urban renewal project, and those, and where eminent domain was used to purchase some properties, I can't tell you it was used to purchase those particular
when
you properties.
You say Bank Street.
Oh.
You mean the Ritz?
No.
No.
Down
here.
Down by Bank the railroad, by the railroad
by
station.
By the railroad.
Those two high rises, and now another one up, going up under construction.
That's affordable housing?
There. No, it's, well, the Bank Street had a 10% set aside for affordable housing through the IDA, and that was a question that you brought up. The IDA helped finance that. And so I think you have to be careful in terms of, there are a lot of older renewal projects where there's still construction going on, and which this would prohibit the use of county money to support affordable housing in those particular developments.
Linda, can I think you draw some to your list as to whether this exception would violate the
Convention. So you're still suggesting the concept, you're in favor of the concept of having the government assist one private owner take over from another private owner?
In the pursuit of affordable housing, which is under the Berenson, Continental, and Triglia cases, are requirements of municipalities and are public purposes. Yes, I am in favor of that.
I think, Tom, I think we're going to have to let
the
next meeting go forward. But thank you.
Thank you.
That's very helpful.
Thanks.
Thank you.
This discussion will continue. I think everybody's pretty much in favor of pursuing this and looking very closely at this. And we just want to make sure we're not preempted. We want to make sure we take into account some very good comments from all the speakers that we need to take into account.
Thank you, everyone.
So thank you. Motion to adjourn?
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
We have environment.
It's only 10 minutes, right?
I know, but I got to
now. I
got to
do like our own opinion.
By the time
down
he gets up, it's
going to
be
25 now.
It's all yours right now. Come on.
There is no preemption.
I don't think it's preemption.
Peter, what do you think?
What? I don't think so.
No. There's a procedure. Yeah. We can't say that you only have 60 days to sewage or something like that. But, you know.
Hi, Marty, Judy, Tom, can we all stay here so we get right to the environment?
Unless you want us to move to the other paper, that'd be easier.
No, let's just stay here.
Right now, so.